Bianca Villa, room 238.
Conceptually difficult. I think for a lot of you that was true. That's probably been true for some of you for everything. Rule 12 is just technically difficult. It has some conceptual components to it, but it's really just familiarizing yourself with the technicalities and its application. And so we're going to do some problems today, and hopefully what we did last class, to the extent that it hasn't sunk in yet, will now sink in a little bit better. These hypotheticals should be pretty easy, but if they're not, you should spend some time after class going over them again with the rules at hand. And if you don't understand them then you can feel free to stop by or talk to someone in your study group or whatever. We've got a lot of people out today. So here's the first hypothetical. These are not from your textbook. These are modified from one of the Glennon books. I don't remember which one. But A files a complaint against B for negligence. B files a motion to dismiss for insufficient service of process. Several months later, the judge denies the motion to dismiss. Okay? So there's a motion for insufficient service of process. Maybe answer the complaint responding to the merits. Maybe answer the complaint responding to the merits. I don't have my face sheet in front of me. Is there a new volunteer here? New enough of us to volunteer? What do you think? No, why? Okay, the answer was no because it's not within 20 days of receiving the summons and complaint. That's not right, but it's a good try. Anybody want to say why that's not right? Nadia? Right. Correct. So under the rules, you have 10 days to file an answer after a judge decides a motion. which, you know, one of the reasons why parties file motions we talked about was to get more time. So with that information in hand, if it's not untimely, do you want to take a crack at the answer? No? Okay. today, I want to take volunteer. I want to take relatively new volunteers today. So if you're not a regular, raise your hand if you want to take this one on.
I'm going to point to somebody. Anybody? Yeah, Jasmine, you're like an intermediate person.
If I know your name, then you're probably someone who volunteers enough. What do you think? There's what? There's no time problem. He could what? He can't answer the complaint. Yeah. The answer is yes. In fact, he has to. Or he's going to default. You know, once you file a motion and you lose, you no longer have a choice of what to do next. You got to file the answer or you're going to lose. You're going to default. Okay, that's that question. Let's do another one. The same facts. All right? The question now is, may B make a motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction? What do you think? The answer is no. Let's try to pinpoint the answer in the rules if we can. Can you tell me, you or anybody else, want to tell me which rule or rules or subsections that you're right? It is no, and you're also right for the reason you gave. Which provision under 12H? Okay, any others? Yeah?
12G2.
Yes, 12G2. It's both. I put on the slide 12G2, but it would also be 12H1 for the reason you said. Okay, now remember that 12G has to do with successive motions, which is what I was sort of getting at here, is a motion. But you're right also that it is waived under 12H as well. Okay, so the answer is no, any way you look at it. Okay, next question. Same facts. Okay? Filed a motion to dismiss, it's denied, maybe include a defense for lack of personal jurisdiction in his answer. What do you guys think? Yeah? What do you think, Cadence? Yeah?
I think no,
Okay, but which provision under Rule 12? Mike? Whoa, what? 15? Okay. Yeah, 12H1. So that was the provision you cited before. And that's the answer to this one. G doesn't apply. Why? Why doesn't G apply to this one? Yeah? Right, it's an answer. So G applies when you're talking about a successive motion, the second motion. Second pre-answer motion. All right. Same facts. May the answer including a failure to state a claim defense. What do you guys think? Angel, what do you think? I'm sorry. I already apologized for Nadia for putting her on the spot last time. What do you guys think? Yeah, Sean?
Well, isn't it about, yes, because Like, after you initially realize that you might put a motion for something else, you can still, like, discover that there's not really a thing once you start looking into it?
The answer is yes. The reasoning might not be right. Okay, because if the hypothetical was changed to say answer including lack of personal jurisdiction, your rationale that, well, you may not have noticed before isn't going to apply. The results are going to be different. So can you tell me what, you're right about the answer, and if you I'm not sure you're right about the reasoning. Why don't you point to a provision in the rule if you can that will support it?
Both
each one, only the complete, but 2 through 5 from B are like creating a waiver. Okay. That's good. That gets you pretty far. You can get a little further, though. Anybody? Yeah. Right. And what does H2A say? Right. So, Sean, you're right. H1 basically doesn't include failure to state a claim as the waivable defenses. But then if you look at H2, it affirmatively tells you that you can file failure to state a claim in an answer. Okay? Even if you fail to raise it in a plea answer motion. All right? Same facts. May be moved to dismiss for failure to state a claim upon which relief may be granted. What do you guys think? This one's a little trickier, yeah? What do you think? What?
No. Isn't it similar to the first question that you asked? You needed to make that motion.
Okay, but does the fact that it's a failure to state a claim create a special circumstance to make it different? James.
Normally under 12G2.
I'm sorry, say it again. You're right.
G2.
Right.
There's a limitation on the motion.
Right.
It's a acceptance of value 12H2.
Right.
Which is the
So your answer is what?
So yes.
Yeah, his answer is yes. You're right. The only caveat I would say is the timing of it. I'm not sure a judge would let you raise it before you file an answer. If you've already filed a pre-motion, although the rules, there's a little bit of a gap in the rules on that. Chances are you could do it, but file an answer first and then do it. Is probably the correct. And that's if you, it's sort of between 12G2 and H2, yeah. Okay. See, 12H2 says a motion under Rule 12C, but that's after the pleadings come in. And so it's probably when that would be, most courts would say that that's when you should do it, when, after the pleadings come in. All right. Same facts. Move to dismiss for lack of subject matter jurisdiction. Second motion. What's your name again? What is it? Audrey, what do you think? Do you think the answer is yes? Under what provision? Ball B1. All Ball B1 does is list it as a defense. Anyone want to help out? Ray? Dan?
Yeah.
Dan.
12H3.
Right, 12, and Audrey just got it. Right, 12H3. Okay, if the court determines at any time, and that could be on its own motion or by a party's motion, subject matter jurisdiction, you could always raise. So even if it's a second one, and even if it's a second motion, and even if it's a second motion pre-answer, it's going to be allowed. Because
the faster you can decide that, the better. All right. Any questions? All right, we're going to change the facts a little bit. This comes from problem one in your textbook. Defendant makes a pre-answer Rule 12b6 motion. That's a failure to state a claim. Upon its denial, she files a second pre-answer motion based on Rule 12b2, seeking a dismissal for want of personal jurisdiction. Has the defendant waived the personal jurisdiction objection? Should be pretty easy for you guys now. Yes? What's your name?
Ebony.
Okay. And which provisions of the rule would you rely on? You're right. It is waived. What is it? 12b2, which is what? Preclusion of a successive motion. And there's another one, which there's going to be another one that applies too. Jamoki? Right, 12h1. So under either one, this is waived. Okay? All right, let's do the next problem. Problem 1b. Did you not get that here in the front? It's waived under 12h1 and 12g2. Okay? All right. Now, I think I mentioned that I was going to number the slides, and I have. I don't know if you can see it. They're up there in the orange. Okay? I hope that's big enough for you to see. If it's not, I could maybe try to move them somewhere. But that's where it like defaults to. Can you see that? No? Okay. It's not going to do any good, though. Some are saying yes. Some of you have to go to the eye doctor. It's pretty small. All right. Let me play around with it and see if I can make it bigger somehow. So, I just gave you the answer. What's the answer? The defense is waived under 12H1. Any questions about that one? Alright. Good, you guys, either you're just not telling me that you have questions or you're getting it. Defendant makes no pre-answer motion, but answers the complaint, and includes in her answer a personal jurisdiction defense. Is the defense waived? Sabrina?
Okay, no.
Why? Right. So you're saying it's sort of, you're right on both fronts. The first is yes, and the first point's an important one, which I stressed a couple times last class. Whether or not to bring a motion is completely optional. And so if you don't make a pre-answer motion and you want to raise a defense, you can, not only can you make it in your answer, but if the defense you're raising is personal jurisdiction, you should raise it immediately in your answer. Because courts don't want you to wait, and not only raise it, but you should litigate it. You know, you should raise it, and at that point, file a motion, bring it to the court's attention. In other words, when you file an answer, nothing happens automatically. So if you're saying there's a personal jurisdiction defense, it's just going to sort of sit there on a piece of paper in the court file. And the second point of Sabrina's answer was that the defendant raising a personal jurisdiction defense in an answer should bring it to the court's attention by way of a motion. In this case, it would be a post-answer motion, but it should be a motion. But what the court doesn't want to see is somebody putting something in their answer, going through discovery, and saying, oh, I have a fucking case here. Now I'm filing my motion to dismiss the personal jurisdiction. So, yes, they should bring it, they can bring it, and they should bring it to the court's attention as soon as possible. The other point, just to remember, is that these Rule 12G and H waivers kick in only when the defendant opts to file a motion and omits a defense. In this case, they opted not to file a pre-answer motion. Okay, let's do 1D. Defendant makes a pre-answer B1 motion, which is denied. She then makes a pre-answer B2 motion, challenging personal jurisdiction. Is the second motion challenging personal jurisdiction waived? Miriam? Okay, the answer is yes. Under which provision?
12G2.
Okay, under 12G2. Second motion. All right. Now, what if the first motion was a Rule 12B2 motion? Would a second motion under Rule 12B1 be barred? Igor?
No.
No, why?
Right, because
of 12H3. Notice the difference here. Now, the one that we're maybe waiving is a subject matter jurisdiction defense, and you can't waive a subject matter jurisdiction defense. But don't get confused with this. If the first one you bring is a subject matter jurisdiction defense, you will waive everything from B2 to B5 if you don't raise them at the same time you bring your subject matter jurisdiction defense. So let's not get those scenarios confused. All right. Let's go on to E. Defendant makes a Rule 12F motion to strike a scandalous allegation from the complaint. You should have by now looked at Rule 12F to see what it's the motion to strike, and you probably read it on your own time. Has the defendant waived the personal jurisdiction objection? I'm sorry. She then makes a Rule 12B motion. Has the defendant waived the personal jurisdiction objection? This one's a little bit different because we're getting out of the 12Bs a little bit. What do you guys think? I keep forgetting your name. Devalina. Okay, why? Let's see, 12G2. Okay, now what is I'll just say it instead of asking it. Now, if you look at 12B2, it says, except as provided in Rule 12H2 or 3, a party that makes a motion under this rule, must not make another motion. So what this problem is directed at is to highlight that it doesn't have to just be another 12B motion, right? A Rule 12F motion is a motion under this rule. It's not 12B, but it's 12F. And so the answer is yes, it's waived. For all the same reasons we said, this problem was intended just to expose you beyond the 12B context to show that it still would apply. Any questions about that? Yes, Rena?
No, right?
What did it say?
We do not say that it's waived under 12H.
Right. It's not waived under 12H1 because those are listing the defenses raised in 12. Well, hold on. Say it. Go ahead. Say it again. 12H,
two and three,
right? No, in 12H2, if you read it, it talks about a rule 19B claim, failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted, or a legal defense, and a motion to strike is not a legal defense. Yes. Yes. Under Rule 8, same result. Any other questions? All right. Did you have something?
I have a question about that.
Okay.
If you don't understand what the complaint is, you have to bring that up before you ask for clarification. You have to bring up the defense. How can you question the defense and you don't know it? You just said 12.
Right.
Do you want a more definitive statement? How does that make sense?
Well, if you make a motion for a more definitive statement, it depends on. If everybody looks at 12H, so the party may move for a more definitive statement of a pleading in which a response to the pleading is allowed. Okay, but basically what that's getting at is the complaint you receive is too ambiguous. All right? Now, if you look back at Rule 12G2, okay,
Volunteer 2 talks about a party making a motion under this rule must not make another motion raising a defense or objection that was available to the party but omitted from the earlier motion. And Miriam's point is a good one, and she's really getting to the interplay between those two things. Maybe you might have a situation, for example, where you couldn't raise defense the first time around because it wasn't on the face of the complaint. It wasn't clear from the face of the complaint, which is why you'd ask for a more definitive statement. Okay? Something like personal jurisdiction, however, might very well exist on the face of the complaint, and you still might need a more definitive statement. So you have to look at what the basis for the claim for a more definitive statement is to determine whether or not you could have raised some subsequent defense. Does that make sense?
So the answer is 12G2, unless you could not have raised it to begin with. Because it wasn't clear.
Right.
And that should
right. But not on this problem. This is 12F. If it was 12E, then you're right.
If 12E is right.
Yes. Yep.
If it's unclear, would it be better strategies just go right away or no?
Yes. Yes. I mean, even if you're asking for a more definitive statement, you're generally going to know whether or not you have a personal jurisdiction defense. Because you know where you live, you know where you're incorporated, you know, there might be facts that make it a close call. But you don't want to take a chance with that. So if you think you can make an argument, you should. You can always fix it when you get the additional information. It would certainly be prudent.
I guess the place where you have the most trouble would be in subject matter jurisdiction, and you can raise that anyway. You may put
right.
up an antitrust, and then when they clarify it, it's court.
Right. In which case you could raise that at any time anyway. Any other questions? Okay. Defendant moves to transfer venue under 28 U.S.C. 1404. After transfer is denied, she moves to dismiss under Rule 12b2. Has the defendant waived the personal jurisdiction objection? What do you guys think about that one? So you want to, Sabrina? It's probably tricky. The answer is it depends on the jurisdiction. Simone, what do you think? You think it's tricky?
I think it's
you're not necessarily moving to transfer venue based on an improper venue. When you're under 1404, the venue is actually correct, and you're moving to the convenience of the parties. You make a 1406 motion for transfer venue, and the venue is incorrect, but under 1404, the venue has to be correct. Well, what's the issue? I mean, Sabrina makes a point. Well, it probably depends. It's a tough call. It's tricky. That's right. Sabrina, what do you think? What would be the arguments, or what are the considerations going one way or the other? Well, let me ask you more pointedly, and you could tell me to move on anytime you feel like you don't want to answer the question anymore. But I think you'll get there. If you were applying the rules technically, if you were applying Rule 12 technically, what would be the result? What are you saying?
Right, and so would that help or hurt?
That would probably hurt. Yeah.
Okay, maybe you disagree with that? Yeah, what do you think?
Doesn't you want to say that promotion under this rule, and so I mean, the original one has to be under this 12 or it could be meeting?
Well, right, that's the argument, and then what would the result be there? The what? It would not be waived. Right. So the issue that this is intended to highlight, and Sabrina's absolutely correct, it is a tricky question, and the court's argued on it,
is whether or not you read Rule 12G, and it talks about making a motion under this rule in 12G1, but probably even more so in Rule 12G2, where it talks about the limitations. It says a party that makes a motion under this rule must not make another motion under this rule. And here the first motion wasn't under this rule. It was under 1404. But so as on a technical application of the rules, the answer is no, it's not waived. But some courts have ruled otherwise. Can you think of why or conceive of why from a policy perspective? Yeah, what's your name again?
Rob.
Rob? You said they should be consistent. Consistent with what?
You said that it doesn't fall under here. It falls under here, and obviously you would be good at the wages.
Right.
But if it doesn't fall under here, it's a question of, how can you actually go up and make a motion that you don't fall under the rules, and then you can make a second motion.
And so, but make it in terms of an argument. Let's say you are arguing for the plaintiff, saying that they've waived it here. Well, what would the actual argument be?
You said that they have waived it because they want to move the transfer.
Right, that's the conclusion of why. I mean, I'm looking for like a policy reason or something, some hook, other than just a conclusive statement. Right. Exactly. And I think you could even say, link it more to Rule 12 and say, for example, look, the policy of Rule 12 is to require the defendant to file these things simultaneously for efficiency reasons. It's to prevent against nickel and diming and, putting it all on the table at one time. So even though the letter of the rule isn't being satisfied, the spirit of the rule would be by allowing precluding the defendant from raising this now. James?
It would, yeah.
Right, well then you get into an issue of what was intended here in statutory interpretation, and that's right, and that's what the courts are looking at. I think the courts probably feel that they have a bit of discretion in this area, but when you're talking about waiving personal jurisdiction, it's hard to see why, since it's a constitutional right, and although we do allow for waivers under certain circumstances, if the rules don't say it expressly, you're really kind of taking the rug from underneath the defendant here, who might have been relying on the letter of the law. It's a problem. Jamoki?
But to bring a 1404 motion, doesn't that mean that the original court has jurisdiction over the case?
Well, they should, but that's a good point.
So if you try to change the venue, you're kind of acknowledging that this court does have jurisdiction, right?
Right.
How do you challenge personal jurisdiction after that?
Right. Well, I think that's probably the answer to James's point. Anybody else want to chime in? But it's an interesting issue, yeah?
Instead of 1404, could you pass the 1406? That's curing my way from the defects of the venue.
Right.
I mean, when you want to file that, because 1404 is actually transferring to a more convenient.
Right. But there's nothing in these facts here to suggest that the venue is necessarily wrong.
No, it doesn't.
I mean, even if, and the point is that even if there's no personal jurisdiction over the defendant, because the plaintiff couldn't prove it, that's different than saying that the defendant waived it, because the defendant could waive personal jurisdiction. And so you can't say, because there's personal jurisdiction. The question becomes whether or not the defendant asserts it or waives it. The defendant could always waive it. Any other questions? Yes? Okay. Let's move on. So the answer is maybe. A motion to transfer venue is not, strictly speaking, a motion under this rule. Some courts have applied the policy that personal jurisdiction objections be raised at the earliest instance. And what do you say?
What's the majority
believe? I don't know. I don't know. I mean, you could look it up. I'm not sure. I'm not sure what the majority view is. Which one do you like? You say no. And Jamogi, which one do you like? That's a fair enough answer. All right. Now, we talked about waiver and collateral tax last time. We spent a few minutes on it, and I did so because we were running out of time in class anyway, and it didn't make sense to move on, but also because it was a very important question. And what I want to do here is sort of highlight some rather interesting inconsistencies between collateral tax and waivability in the personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction context. To understand this, though, you have to sort of keep in mind Moki's point last time, which is that the purposes of subject matter jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction are different. And while we may allow a defendant to waive personal jurisdiction, we're not going to allow the defendant to waive subject matter jurisdiction, which involves the power of the courts. But here's sort of the blackest letter of the law that I can give it to you, although there's a little bit of gray here. For personal jurisdiction, it's vertically waivable. And by vertically waivable, I'm talking about it within one case. Okay, so if you don't raise it in that case, it's waived. Or if you could waive it inadvertently or advertently. Inadvertently because you meant to raise it in an earlier motion and you didn't. Or you could waive it and say, there's no personal jurisdiction over here, but I don't mind litigating in that forum, so that's fine. Okay? Now, collateral attacks are available for personal jurisdiction. Collateral attack, again, means a second proceeding. That's exactly what happened in Norway right now. Okay, collateral attack means you're attacking a judgment in a second proceeding. And for personal jurisdiction, you can collaterally attack, provided, this is a big but, provided that the personal jurisdiction wasn't waived or decided in the original action. So we're going to allow the defendant, and the reason we do that is because when we're talking about power over the person, we want to give the defendant the choice just not to show up at all. You know, if someone's from California, they're being sued in New York, there's no personal jurisdiction in New York, we want to give the defendant the option of just saying, fine, I'll lose there, and I don't want to have to show up in New York to defend myself, and when you come and try to collect against me, I'll challenge it then. And we want to give them that option. Now, subject matter jurisdiction is different. Vertically, it's non-waivable. And by that I mean, and we saw it in Motley, you can raise subject matter jurisdiction at trial level, at the appellate level, or even at the Supreme Court level, within the same case. That's what I mean by it's vertically non-waivable. But now, in terms of collateral attack, the general rule is you can't. The general rule is you can't collaterally attack the absence of subject matter jurisdiction. And what's the reason for that? Anybody? Yeah, Nicole?
Efficiency.
Efficiency, finality. Yeah, I mean, at some point, we just want to say this is over. So if we were allowed a collateral attack for subject matter jurisdiction, what could happen is someone could win a judgment, and then 2 years later, someone goes, oh, wait, there was never a subject matter jurisdiction. We thought there was diversity, but there's not, and undo the judgment, and that would not be a good result. Okay? Now, there are some minor exceptions to this. The Supreme Court has said, you know, if there's some indication that Congress intended to allow for collateral attack, then okay. And also, if it's absolutely or abundantly clear that there's no subject matter jurisdiction, we might allow a collateral attack. You know, one of the examples in your book was, well, what if a justice of the peace issues a divorce decree? I mean, it's just like, there's clearly no jurisdiction to do that, but we wouldn't want to say that a justice of the peace who issued a divorce decree was definitely binding the absentee spouse or partner in that marriage.
So, like, you know, that's sort of getting into the world of imaginary and hypotheticals, but there are some limits to this general rule that collateral attacks and subject matter jurisdiction won't be allowed. Yeah, Elliot?
I don't understand why
why is it a bigger efficiency problem by subject matter jurisdiction than by person jurisdiction?
That's a good question. The reason I gave you this chart is to point out these differences. Is the answers are not always easy. Anyone want to take a guess or stab at that one? Do you have an idea as to why maybe?
The court values the rights of the person over the rights of the system.
Well, in that context, it may be. So in the context of, person versus efficiency, the court is going to weigh the values in favor of the person. But when we're talking about, efficiency versus the authority of a federal court stepping on the toes of a state court, then we're going to let efficiency win out there because that's in the better general interest of the country as a whole. It's probably as good as you'll come up with. But if anybody else wants to chime in, be happy to hear it. All right. So that brings us to the end of the Rule 12 stuff. And we're going to move on now to theory. You know what? Let's just take a break now. Let's take a break now. Strategically, how sure that you are.
The bumper, yeah. Because then you have the right magazine saying, you're wrong, and you can find that it's kind of an answer. And then you can write it.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about federal tax area is the cost benefit analysis. If you move the federal tax, you won't be able to challenge the merits. So, right, because that's the size of the federal tax. Once you challenge the federal tax, so you take the chance to gamble. And you have to decide on how strong you are in the merits and how expensive you are.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Turning to a new topic now, the Erie problem. It's a problem. This is a big problem. I feel like I find myself saying this every time we change subjects, but this one's really hard. This one plagues many a civil procedure student. It's very difficult. Part of what makes it, well, there's two things I think that make it difficult, aside from the fact that it's civil procedure. The first thing is that it's not as going to be as technical as what we just did. You're not going to be able to point to a rule and say, oh, here's the answer. It's going to require a bit of judgment, a bit of balancing, sort of similar to the type of analyses that we did for personal jurisdiction, for example. Sort of multifaceted analysis, so on and so forth. The second part is that there's a constitutional dimension to the hearing problem. And as you guys haven't had constitutional law yet, it's sort of hard to grab all the nuances of it. I'm going to sort of simplify a little. You don't need to know all of the nuances, and I'll give you what you need to know, but there is that element of the Erie problem that makes it difficult for some people. Now, I had another general comment. Anyway, let's start. There's two flavors, chocolate and vanilla, with choice of law problems. The chocolate, the first one, is as between federal law and state law. Talking about, you have two different laws, state and federal, and as between that, which one's going to apply? Right? Choice of law problem. That's sometimes referred to as vertical choice of law. I'm not sure that's really the best word for it, because it connotes a hierarchy between the federal and the state system, whereas really there sort of exists in parallel dimensions. But let's stick with vertical, because it's going to help us distinguish between what I think is a pretty good characterization of horizontal. So the first one is between federal law and state law. And the problem arises because of the overlapping power that the federal judiciary and the state judiciaries have. Remember that federal courts exercise authority over state law issues when? Miriam? Right, in diversity cases. And when would state courts have jurisdiction over federal issues? Yeah. What did I say? Someone waived the diversity. Sort of. Might be able to say it a little better. Anybody else want to? What do you mean by that? Someone waives the diversity.
If they're going to someone, if it's a state court and someone wants to move it to federal court, they decide to waive the diversity to state court.
Yeah, that's right. There might be a little bit of an easier way to say it. That's right, though, Rob. Max?
You might have supplemental jurisdiction, and they're breaking the knowledge of state claims, and the federal issue would probably go back to the state.
The federal issue would go back?
If the state claims outweigh the federal issue, then the state would.
That's true. That's in that way, the state court might hear a federal issue. But even more generally, remember that state courts have jurisdiction over just about everything. Which means they have jurisdiction over state claims, they have jurisdiction over almost all federal claims, too. Right? There's only a very small class of federal claims that have exclusive jurisdiction in the federal court. Your antitrust, your bankruptcy, your securities law, and a few others. But even things like First Amendment challenges, Title VII discrimination claims, all those kinds of federal claims, almost always can be brought in state court too. So you have this real overlapping of power. What we're concerned with principally, though, is what is a federal court to do for diversity actions in state court. Which law, federal or state, is the federal court that will go into apply? That's the issue that we're going to be focusing on. Now, there's a second choice of law issue, this is vanilla, is between one state and another state. Okay, so you have a conflict between New York law and New Jersey law. And the problem here is a little bit different. It arises not because of overlapping power between the state courts of New Jersey and New York. It arises because of the overlapping actions. You know, a lot of claims in today's day are not local. They cross state lines. You know, if there's some action in one state, some action in another state, that's why we have specific jurisdictions. You know, that's what we have international shoe and its expansion of Knoyer. So when we have causes of action that are arising in more than one place, then it raises question about which state law to apply. Now, obviously, if the law is the same in New York and New Jersey, it doesn't matter which law you apply. And so you don't have to worry about choice of law problems. Okay? Or if the law is the same between a state and a federal court, you don't have to have a choice of law. It's not a problem. It's just an observance at that point. Because there's no conflict. You just apply either one, you're going to get the same result. The problem is when the rules are different. The rules of one state are different than the rules of another state, or the rules of the federal system are different than the rules of the state system. Which law to apply? And the answer for... we're going to talk about this briefly later in a couple of classes. We're going to focus on this one. The answer to that question is in large measure constitutional. And that's, so I want to digress now for a little bit and talk a little bit about more about the problem and how the what the Constitution has to do with it. Now, before I even get there, what is the Constitution? I just remembered the other point I wanted to make. This stuff is theoretical. So don't sit back and just wait for the bottom line and say, I'm not going to worry about the theory stuff because at the end I'll get the bottom line somewhere later. You will not understand the bottom line if you don't understand the theory. And that's why I'm going slowly and I want to take you through the theory. You need to understand the theory this time. I think the theory is certainly very, very helpful for everything we've done. But this is, if you don't understand the theory, you don't have a chance of understanding how to apply this stuff in practice. So let's talk a little bit about theory, or I should say a lot about theory. What is the Constitution, generally? You know, I'm sure there's any number of correct answers, but what's the Constitution, Alexi? It is the supreme law of the land. What was the purpose of the Constitution? What did it accomplish? Why do we need a Constitution? Kunal?
To guideline the allocation of power.
Allocation of power as between who?
Between state and, I guess, individual states and the whole unity of the whole group as all states combined.
Right. What he said is sort of drawing the boundaries between the state on the one hand, both relative to each other, but even more importantly, relative to some supreme federal authority that would sort of act as an umbrella over the entire system. I mean, essentially, in some ways, it's a contract. I use the term loosely, but in some ways, it's a contract. You know, before there was a constitution, all of the power devolved upon the states and the individuals within the states. And what the Constitution is, roughly speaking, theoretically and roughly speaking, is the states giving away power to the federal government. You know, if you think about it, all the states, the power residing with the people of the state, they're giving power to the government for the general good, because they feel that by giving away certain power, that's going to benefit them, and also it's going to benefit the country as a whole. So, when you think about, you need to sort of remember that, when you think about the federal government, you tend to think of like this all-powerful entity. But that's not really, it is and it's not true. It's true in this sense. When you have a conflict between federal and state deciding what the answer is going to be, then often, and there's going to be some exceptions, then often what the federal says is going to go. Okay, so if you have a federal statute on point,
and the state statute conflicts with it, if the federal statute says X and the state statute says not X, well then the federal government, the statute is going to prevail. So in that sense, the federal government is all-powerful. But it's also less powerful, because it's, the powers of the government or of the federal government are limited in scope. They only have those powers that are enumerated in the Constitution. Was there a hand up, Rob?
I was just wondering about, I know in California they have issues because the state says they're allowed to have medical marijuana, but the federal court says not. How can there be an issue?
I'm not even going there. Not even going there. Okay. That's something for con law that you'll learn about, okay? This is tough enough. This is hard enough. So, turning back to the, not that it's a bad question, it's not for this class. Okay, so, turning back to the Constitution, structurally, you can look at Articles 1, 2, and 3, and Article 1 governs Congress's authority. Remember, this is the authority that the states are sort of ceding to the federal government. And if you look at Congress's authority, it generally is the authority to make the laws. But not just any laws. It only has the authority to make the laws that are enumerated in Article 1. And you can take a look at those and list it as to what they can make laws as to. What's not there, for example, are laws to... Congress is not authorized to pass contract statutes that don't, like a contract that's signed in state that has nothing to do with any other states. Congress has no authority to legislate in the area of just general in-state contracts. They have certain authority to legislate, but it doesn't extend everywhere. And Article 2 is the executive's authority. And Article 3, and this might even help like the light bulb go off for a couple of you, we've been sort of talking about Article 3 a lot, but sort of not, maybe you didn't understand where it sort of fits in. Article 3 is the judiciary's authority. So you know enough to tell me, what is the judiciary's authority under Article 3? What is the judiciary's authority under Article 3? Jen? What do you say? They create the common law. What do you mean by that? We're talking about that this is federal. Okay. We're talking about this is under the Constitution what the federal.
Am I totally wrong?
I'm not going to answer that. You're not totally wrong, but they don't have. I'd have to hear more of your answer before I say that you're totally wrong. So if you're more than welcome to try to elaborate more.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll come back to it. Ruby?
I think that with the structure of the court, the Supreme Court and the other essay.
Okay, so that's part of Article 3, that's Section 1. What does Section 2 say?
Judicial power that is given all equity.
Yeah, if you look at, take a look at Article 3, Section 2. If you're looking at our shared book here. It's on page 284. And Section 1 is the one we just described, which basically creates a Supreme Court and affords Congress the authority to make any inferior court. And then Section 2 goes on to list, that's the one we've been looking at, Section 2, goes on to list cases and controversies that the federal courts are authorized to hear. Right? So included in that is what? Yeah? Subject matter jurisdiction. What kind of subject matter jurisdiction? Diversity, for example. What else, for example? Say it again. Right, federal question. Yeah, federal question. So that's all this stuff is coming from. This is the authority of the judiciary. We hear cases and controversies, and well, what does that mean? Well, under cases, it includes, but it's not limited to, you can read what they all are, we've only been focused on, cases arising under the federal laws or the Constitution or treatises, so-called federal questions. It also includes diversity cases. So that's the judiciary's authority.
And remember, it's limited. Remember, it's for the same reason we said subject matter jurisdiction is limited. They can't hear claims over just any case. They have to be the types that are enumerated in Section 2. Now, Congress has limited those a little bit further, but the starting point to determine what the federal courts potentially could hear are listed in Article 3, Section 2. And there's another important one, the 10th Amendment, which is probably true even before the 10th Amendment was passed, or true enough, but it certainly spelled it out. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively, or to the people. That's basically what we talked about to begin this conversation. Whatever powers are not given to the federal government are left with the states or the people.
These are the building blocks for understanding the cases that we're going to be studying in this section.
And they should become apparent to you as we get more in-depth into them. So, with that background, the sort of the takeaway is the federal government is one of limited enumerated powers. By enumerated, I mean the powers that are listed in Articles 1, 2, and 3, and elsewhere. But those are the biggies. If it's not enumerated, then the power is with who? The states, right. Or the people. But the states, generally. Okay? Any questions about that? That's a crash course in sort of separation of powers and federalism. Much more of that to come in con law. So, in the first judicial act, which at the same time that the Congress created the lower federal courts, it also passed something called the Rules of Decision Act. The Rules of Decision Act. And it's not artfully worded. It says, the laws of the several states, except where the Constitution or acts of Congress otherwise require or provide, shall be regarded as the rules of decision in civil actions in the courts of the United States in cases where they apply. Now, I could have rewritten this any number of ways to have made it clearer than that. In its simplest form, the RDA basically provides that in diversity cases, you know, provided that there's no federal law conflicting with the state law, that the state law will apply. That's in its simplest form what it means. Okay? Or stated otherwise, you know, in diversity cases, remember, these are cases where the parties diverse and they're in the federal court based on diversity jurisdiction. In diversity cases, you know, state law is going to apply unless there's a federal law that directly conflicts with it. That's what we talked about before. Okay? Now, even as simplified, though, the issue remains pretty complicated. Why is that? Where's the tension, where's the tension in the language of this statute, David? Where does it talk about law?
The laws of the states.
Okay, it says the laws of the several states, and so what's the issue there? What's the ambiguity there?
Is it talking about statutes or talking about precedents?
Right. What do they mean by laws? Laws come in many different forms. Statutes, interpretations of statutes, what Jen was talking about earlier, the common law. So it comes from a lot of places. Now, there's another potential problem here, too, which is what? Alexi? Okay. So that's good. That's true also. And we're going to get to that. That's another one. That wasn't what I was talking about, but you're right. That is another problem that the Supreme Court has had to struggle with. There's another one. The one immediately following it. The first clause. Anyone? Rob, you want to try?
And so what's the issue, what's the problem there? Maybe slightly stated differently. I mean, basically, the problem is, when does something conflict? You know, when are we going to say that something actually conflicts? When federal law conflicts with state law so that it's trump state law. So these are sort of the problems in the Rules of Decision Act. And it was some of the issues were first taken up in SWIFT, which is in your textbook. I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions about SWIFT. Some of them I got from, you know, they omit a lot large swaths of the decision, obviously, but they pick up again with it later when talking about Erie. So if you've read SWIFT and Erie, you should be able to answer most of these questions. What's confusing about SWIFT are the facts. Let me just give you briefly what happened. Basically, there's a third party, meaning someone who's not a litigant here, not the plaintiff, not the defendant, somebody else, received a bill of exchange, which is roughly an IOU. I'm not going to get into the specifics, but if you think of it as an IOU, that'll help. From the defendant as part of the sale of property. So this third party was selling some piece of property to the defendant. The defendant says, I'll give you this note or this IOU, which you could cash. It'll be ready in 6 months. You'll be able to cash this in. The third party ends up signing over the bill of exchange to the plaintiff. Okay, basically, it's like think of it as like an endorsement on the back of the check, and which basically gives the plaintiff the right to collect on the bill. Okay, when the plaintiff then sues defendant to enforce it. But when the plaintiff does that, the defendant wants to defend on the ground that the original transaction for the property sale was the result of fraud. He's essentially saying, because that was fraudulent, I never would have given the note, the plaintiff now shouldn't have a right to collect against me. And what the plaintiff essentially is saying, well, maybe that's so, but when I got the note, the IOU, I had no idea about this alleged fraud we're talking about now. And so there's an issue as to whether or not the plaintiff, who had no knowledge of it and was just engaging in a business transaction with a third party, somehow is going to be left holding a blank piece of paper because of some information in the prior transaction that the plaintiff knew nothing about. That's essentially the factual scenario. The policy considerations that might go into it is, well, you know, obviously you want to protect the defendant against fraud. You know, the defendant is now stuck having to pay a bill for a property sale that was based on a piece of property that a third party allegedly didn't even own. Okay, that was a fraud. So that's the argument from a policy perspective of the defendant, and from a policy perspective for the plaintiff, does anyone want to take a shot at it? And as a commercial law principle, we want to promote commerce, and if we're not going to allow plaintiffs to accept over notes or IOUs, then that's going to be a hindrance to commerce. And so these are sort of the competing interests at play. And you're going to learn more about this stuff. You're taking property now?
No.
So you might learn more about the stuff. It's bona fide purchasers and all that stuff in property law. That's more than you need to know for SWIFT, because SWIFT is really important for its legal conclusion. But I think it helps to sort of understand the facts. Okay. Now, how did New York resolve? Well, let me ask you this first. Where does plaintiff sue? Where did plaintiff sue? Let's see. I see your hand, but let me see if anybody else has it. Yeah, what do you think? Where did plaintiff
sue? Yes, the District Court of New York.
Okay, the plaintiff sues in the District Court of New York. Now, did New York... Did the New York courts, state courts, resolve the issue about whether or not defendant can bring in this argument about the fraud? Do you know?
What?
Tom? According to the text, the New York courts have spoken on a substantive issue ruling that nulls for subject to member defenses.
Okay, so that's the answer, right. So the answer is, under New York law, the answer was yes. And they, under New York law, it would have allowed a defendant to come in and do this. So what about under federal law? What was the result under federal law? And when I say federal law, I should be a little bit more specific. What was
the result in the New York federal courts? What was the sort of the going rule there? You said what?
There wasn't any rule,
or there was, or the opposite of New York? It's
not entirely clear, or at least it wasn't to me. It's either that there's no rule, one is still an open question, or I think what it was, though, is that it was the opposite of what the New York rule was, which would have precluded this result. Okay? Did it say it right there? What does it say?
Since diversion cases are in federal court, and then you have a party citizenship, there isn't any federal law to apply.
Say that, where are you?
Stop at 223, same, instead of starting with same.
Well, I think what they're saying, there's no federal law to apply, is I think they're saying that that's a little bit of a different issue. They're saying that there's no federal, you know, statute or whatever. I don't think they're talking about whether or not the federal courts have resolved this specific issue. In other words, there's and we'll talk about this more later, but there's statutes, and then there's judge-made law, which is interpretation of the statutes. Now, there's clearly no federal statute on this point. The question was whether or not whether the judges in New York federal court have decided that point. And I'm not sure that the answer was clear from the text. And so that explains, I think, why, or it should be obvious to you, why the plaintiffs decided to sue in federal court rather than state court.
But if the plaintiff sues in state court and knows what the state court judge is going to do, then the plaintiff is more likely going to lose.
But if the plaintiff files in federal court, the plaintiff is more likely to win. And so that's an introduction of the sort of this problem of getting contrary results depending on which court, state or federal, they sue in. Now, we talked about, the New York state court. The New York State Court having a rule that says that the defendant wants to raise can be raised. Where is that rule coming from? What's the source of that rule? What's the source of that rule? Is it like pulling that thin air? Yes, Kristen?
Cases,
right? But what's the source of that? It's judge-made law. But where's the judge coming up with the answer? I mean, is the judge just flipping a coin, or?
It's New York case law.
Okay, that's right. And so, but it's got to, if you trace the lineage of the New York case law back, where is it? Where is its genesis? Yes.
Commercial law.
And what does the court mean by commercial law? And where's that law coming from? The common law. Okay, so Jen, getting back to your earlier point. The common law. Now, what's the common law? What's the common law? This is a sort of a tough question, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, you're not wrong. The problem with the term common law is there's people use it to mean different things in different contexts.
Okay, sometimes people say common law, they mean case law. When they're talking about common law or general common law in this context, what they're talking about is the law as it existed in England at the time the Constitution was created. In other words, there was a body of law in England which was judge-made law, some of it was, whatever, statutory judge-made law, whatever, and there were treatises and went back to, I don't know when, mid-1500s, 1400s, or maybe even before. But there's a body of law from England, and when our country was founded, we basically accepted all that law as ours.
And so when they're talking about the common law in this context, or the general common law, they're talking about the law in England. So, conceptually, there's no such thing as New York general common law or Pennsylvania common law.
In the sense that I'm using the term now. All there is there is a common or general common law, and what you have are the individual states trying to figure out what that is. Because the general common law doesn't address all the questions that might arise under specific factual circumstances. And so you have the courts trying to, of the individual states, trying to, looking at the same treatises dated from 1650, looking at the same case law from the courts in England, trying to figure out what would they do? What would they do if they were faced with this situation? Rob? No. No, common law, when I talk about common law, I'm talking about judge-made law or sort of these judge-made principles that existed at the time of the Constitution. Okay, because once the Constitution was entered into, we became our own country, and then we started developing our own law. Okay, but our own law was really just an interpretation, putting aside statutes, which are a whole other thing. Our own judge-made law was really just an interpretation of the common law that preceded the Constitution. It's sort of been one continuous thing. Now, what was the issue essentially in Swift with that background? What was the issue? Yeah?
Was New York law going to apply in federal law? Was New York law really law?
Well, right. It's really the second thing you said. And it's a little bit more specific. What the second part you said is New York state law really, is the New York rule, is it really law? But let's go ahead, Nicole.
Were the cases part of the law of New York binding on federal
courts? Yeah, I mean, the question is, are the laws of New York, stated differently, binding on the federal courts that are sitting in New York? And if you turn back to, and this is really important, the issue was really one of statutory interpretation for the Supreme Court. They said, you know, when the Rules of Decision Act talks about the laws of the several states, does that include judge-made interpretation of the English common law? And what did the court hold in Swift? What did the court hold? Mary, you're shaking your head no, but why?
Because it's not true law. It's precedent.
Well, precedent means that, well, precedent to me means that you have to follow it. So, but in fact, saying the opposite.
But don't laws really come from statutes, true law? I thought that's what they were looking at.
Well, that's what the majority is sort of suggesting. They say, well, it's not that true laws. I think what the majority is saying is, When Congress said laws in the statute, what they meant were, well, let's start with what they didn't mean. What they didn't mean was judge interpretation of the common law. And the theory behind it is this. Basically, if there really is one true common law out there from which all of the other judges in the world are trying to glean its meaning, there's no reason why a federal judge should have to defer to what a state judge says. I mean, under Justice Story's approach, you say, you know, the state judge could go out there and read all the treatises and read all the case law and try to guess what the answer to the true common law is, but a federal court is in just as good a position to do the same thing. And so, according to Justice Story's view in Swift, the state decision is not binding. It doesn't mean we're going to ignore it necessarily, because they may be right, it may be influential, they may have found a source that someone else wouldn't have thought of, and it might be right, but it only because it's persuasive, not because it's binding. It might be right only because it's persuasive, not because it's binding. James?
Well, so trying to the topic or issue at hand, like the local issues and how why the state was, but on the general issue.
Right, so, right, which is where I'm going. We're going to get there. Okay. Now,
The court assumed that the Constitution afforded the federal judiciary the authority to interpret the general common law without regard to the states. Okay, so for Swift, it's not really a constitutional issue. It just sort of assumed that the Constitution let the federal judges decide the meaning of general common law without regard to what the state did. The question was whether Congress limited that constitutional power by the statute of the Rules of Decision Act. And this sort of framework should not be unfamiliar to you. For questions of subject matter jurisdiction, we do the same thing. We say, does Article 3 grant subject matter jurisdiction? And if so, has Congress allowed the courts to exercise the subject matter jurisdiction? No, you always start with the Constitution, and then you see what has Congress said? Has Congress limited the scope of what the Constitution allows? And in Swift, for Justice Story, that was sort of the issue here. Except here, they assume that the Constitution afforded the authority to reach its own conclusions about the general common law. The question was one of statutory interpretation, whether or not Congress in the RDA intended to limit that power, and whether it intended to do so specifically through use of the words laws. And what the Swift Court said, Justice Story says, is that no, laws do not mean judge-made interpretation of the general common law. Now, to James's point, what does... James, you can answer it, maybe you know it. What does Justice Story say the RDA means when it says laws?
For state purpose?
What did it say? Yes, state law. What is meant if it doesn't mean judge-made interpretation of common law, then what did Congress mean in the RDA when it said the law of the states?
Rules and enactments by state legislative authority.
And what does that mean? What's a rule and enactment by a state legislative authority?
Either a rule decided by a state legislative or a judgment.
Okay, let's just stop. Give us, what's the everyday word for a rule by a state-made legislative body? A statute, right. So a statute is included in the word law in the Rules of Decision Act. And what else? Okay, so now, no. Or the answer is yes and no. There's two types of judge-made law that the court talks about. One is judge-made interpretation of the common law, and that one is not covered by the RDA. But there is a judge-made law that is covered by the RDA, according to Swift. What is it? Okay, local matters, that's one. What do they mean by local matters? Yeah, things that are like definitely not leaving the state, title over real estate, things that are in the state, land, like water usage, if there's like something involving water rights that is in the state. The English common law wouldn't necessarily have a say on what the rights over a pond in New York were, right? They probably didn't contemplate that. So things like that are okay, but there's also one other type of judge-made or judge type law that's okay, or that's covered under the RDA according to the Swift Court. No? Actually, you know what? I think it's not included in the brackets in the discussion of Swift, but it is included in the brackets in theory. So I think it's included. Yeah? No. Well, again, it depends. If it's the Supreme Court rules on an interpretation of general common law, then no. No, because that's going to, any judge-made interpretations of the general common law according to Swift are not covered under the RDA.
Well, what I said was in the unwritten law of the state declared by its highest court.
The unwritten law, where are you reading that from?
Page 2.5.
Okay. Where though? I just want to make sure. I mean, if you're going to read it from something, I want to be able to see where you're reading from. Okay.
What's the
okay.
In
ground of diversity of citizenship need not matter in general jurisprudence, apply unwritten law of the state that declares
right. So that's what that's what is not covered, and that goes to what we just talked about. And we're talking about what judge-made law is covered. Decided local stuff. We talked about that. Yeah. No, that would fall under the common law. It's right. If you look in the block quote, it says the true interpretation of the Rules of Decision Act limited its application to state law strictly local, and it defines sort of what that is, and includes statutes and the construction thereof adopted by the local tribunal. So it will include statutes and the judge-made interpretations of statutes. It will include statutes and the judge-made interpretations of statutes. It will not include the judge-made interpretations of the common law, i.e. the law that existed in England before the Constitution. Okay, so some judge law is okay, but it's only the type that's interpreting a statute, and in which case, according to the Swift majority, that would be covered under the RDA, I guess?
Is it possible for a state statute to become common law?
Is it possible for a state statute to become common law? I think that, I mean, we're using like this loose notion of common law. My answer has got to be no. So, common law really is what's existing in the margins between what's not being covered by statutes. So to say that something is a statute means you don't need the common law to fill in the gaps. So to say that something by statute becomes the common law is, I think, technically incorrect. They sort of exist in different worlds. Statutes are on the books passed by legislatures. The common law, and again, there's more than one definition. Eliot's definition earlier is that some people talk about common law as the interpretation even of statutes, because it's not a statute. But what they're talking about here in Swift and Erie in terms of the common law is the common law sort of this thing that's out there that people are trying to understand as it existed before the Constitution.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Back in when the Constitution was written, a local issue back then could have further later on the development of states or the country in general.
I think it's... No, because there's no such thing as a nationwide common law outside of the pre-England common law. You might get state-by-state common law under what Eliot was suggesting, the sort of judge-made fill-in-the-blanks. What you can have, and does happen quite often, is you have judge-made law to state filling-in-the-blanks, which ends up becoming statutory law. The Congress says, you know what, this has sort of been the rule, and let's now make it a statute. Or, this has been the rule, let's not make this a statute. Let's pass a statute that changes what the common law was. That's much more common. Rob? Now, the question is an excellent one, and but it really goes to the point of point of the holding in Swift, is what is the reason why we wouldn't follow state judge-made common law, right? That's the question. And what was your answer? Well, there's no problem with being held to the English common law. That's sort of what Judge Astori would want. He's not challenging that the result in this case needs to be tethered to the common laws that existed in England. What is the answer to your question, though? Yeah.
The answer is that the federal courts can interpret that common law, that same common law, just as well as the state courts.
Right. So that's really what the court is saying in Swift is that assuming that there is this, you know, I don't know if anybody's a philosophy major, like this form out there, that's Platonic form out there, or this true common law out there, then the federal courts are in at least as good a position, both as a practical matter because of their training, but also as a constitutional matter, because there's nothing in the Constitution that prevents them from deciding or interpreting common law. Why should the federal courts be bound to what the state court's saying? That's the Swift approach. That approach ultimately gets overruled in Erie, but that's the position of the Swift approach. Yeah? Sabrina? The question was, do you think that the fact that this involved commercial law had an impact? And what do you think the answer to that is? There's a note about that in the text. Yeah. So it's very possible that, you know, the trend at the time was to sort of expand commercial law, provide protections for people that are accepting bills in exchange. And so, from that perspective, they probably didn't like New York law. And so that could have been a backdoor way of getting to the result. But then remember, this is one of those situations where when you let an issue frame the law, that becomes problematic, because now this becomes the law for 100 years until we get Erie, and then we see some really really odd results that stem from it. But it may have very well been part of the reasoning. They wouldn't say so expressly, but it could have been part of what drove the result. Any questions? Okay. Let me just make sure I... So, after determining that the court was not bound to follow state law, I think we know what happens. The federal court basically says that the defenses were not available, and so the plaintiff took the benefit of the federal law under those circumstances. Now, what's important to highlight is the differences in result that would have been achieved had the plaintiff decided to sue in state court. And so that's really the problem that Erie and some of these other cases are going to resolve. Whether or not there's some justifiable reason, constitutional or otherwise, why a plaintiff should get one result in state court and a different result in federal court. So, now if Congress... Because this is sort of an important little point. If Congress didn't approve of the decision of Swift, what could it have done? What could Congress have done if it didn't approve the decision of Swift? Candace, sorry. I had a Candace in my other class. That's my excuse.
They could have changed the law.
Okay, so they could have amended the law. What could they have done to amend the law? What could they have done specifically? Well, let's say they wanted to. Let's say they just wanted to. Am I going backwards? What if they just wanted to amend the statute? What could they say? Right. So they could have just said, the laws of the several states, including statutory, judge-made, interpretation of common law, whatever language, probably would have picked bad language, to be consistent with the bad language they picked already. But something to try to get the point across that what they intended to cover was more than just what the Supreme Court said the word laws meant. What else could there? Now, there's something else probably more dramatic that Congress could have, or arguably could have done. To fix the problem, what's that? Pass a new law, which is what Cadence just said. Yeah? Restrict the jurisdiction how?
Because Congress has the power to.
But how? Yes. Congress has the power, but how specifically might they have restricted the jurisdiction? They eliminated all the courts?
Well, they could, but. They could just say that they're not equipped to handle matters of federal law, or they could just say that the federal districts will be bound by the law of the states in which they are located.
Right, they could have done that. The earlier point was more, I think, more, at least what I was. There's lots of ways to change the law. But the more dramatic way was what you were touching on, is they could restrict the subject matter jurisdiction. But they could do it more specifically. They don't have to just get rid of all subject matter jurisdiction, right, Jamoki?
Take away diversity.
Take away diversity jurisdiction. That's the one that's bothering us now.
Right? Because if it's a federal question, we're not going to have this problem.
Because in federal question cases, we know which law to apply. We apply federal law. It's in the diversity cases where there's concurrent jurisdiction in, that is starting to trouble us. Okay.
Now, if federal, to clarify, when I said you'd have to apply federal law, that's because even if a federal law case is in state court, you'd be applying federal law there too. Right? So the federal law is going to be supreme.
But with respect to diversity cases, the issue is less clear. Because the cases are arising, you know, in the states, they're arising based on state laws,
and the only reason they're in federal court is because Congress has said that they can be, or the Constitution has said that they can be, and Congress has said, well, that's okay. Now, did Congress do anything? Did the Congress amend this after Swift? Do you have a question? Well, let me just get an answer to that. Did Congress do anything? What did it say? Yeah.
No, because I don't know what the whole post is.
Okay, the answer is no, because it could have opened up a whole host of new problems. I don't know why they didn't. It may have been because they agreed with the Swift approach, but maybe because they were afraid of what would happen if they amended it, or they waited, or maybe if they just never got on their calendar because they were too busy doing other things. But for whatever reason, they never amend it. And, 100 years goes by, and then we get Erie. And which we'll talk about next week.
But it's important for you to understand what Swift said so that you can understand what Erie overruled. All right, and then after Erie, we're going to talk about the other cases that are interpreting Erie.
And this is stuff that, let's take it one step at a time, because it gets complicated. We're going to get past Erie next week, so I'll read the next assignment after Erie as well. We're not going to... Well, I shouldn't say. I'll send you an email. I'm not sure whether we're going to get to Semtech or not. But we're definitely going to get Theory and the one after. Okay? What about something brought under a federal question and New York State judges interpreting?